With Strings Attached, Chapter 3, Part 1, Aliens. "Wait!" Paul shouted after the small figure, taking a few steps as if to follow it. But the being only ran harder, and in seconds it had scrambled up the rise, darted into the meadow, and receded out of sight. Paul stopped, not altogether sorry he hadn't pursued harder. For one thing, he would have run right out of his laceless shoes. "Funny," Ringo murmured behind him. "They're supposed to scream and run at us." The tambourine jingled faintly in his shaking hand. "Jesus!" squeaked John, hugging his guitar to him like a shield. His cloak of insanity, put on so he wouldn't have to think, had fallen off, leaving naked fear. "Oh God, oh God, oh God, we're gonna die!" George closed his eyes and repeated his mantra, calming himself. Taking a deep breath, Paul put his guitar down and went up to the lettuce bush to look at the fallen sack. He did not fail to notice the little person's footprints, sharply outlined bare human feet, in the wet sand near the water. A leprechaun? Hobbit? Glancing at the meadow to make sure the being or its friends weren't going to swoop down on him, he picked up the sack. Made of coarse brown material, it was sodden and caked with sand at the bottom. Paul peered carefully within and got a noseful of fishy-smelling vegetable for his pains. He retched and closed the sack. "Seaweed!" he called to the others, most of whom were slowly coming to join him. "Come on, we'll bring it back to him, and maybe he'll talk to us." But John stayed right where he was, a stick figure in the sand. "I ain't going after him, no way!" he yelled. "Oh no, not again." "Ah, come on, mate," Paul said, a masterpiece of self-control, when he itched to grab John and frog-march him along. "You can't stay here forever."
"Watch me!"
Then George turned to look at John. While he didn't smile, he seemed calm and composed, almost serene. "Look fear in the face, and it won't bother you anymore," he intoned. Then, following his own dictum, he took the sack from Paul and started into the meadow, trying to keep the bag from bumping the guitar across his body, walking carefully so as not to lose his shoes.
"Wait for us!" Paul barked at George's receding back, which kept receding.
"Shit!" he muttered, running his fingers through his hair. "They couldn't split up. They couldn't! That would be the worst thing they could do!"
"So what are you going to do, then?" he snapped at Ringo, who stood quietly nearby. "Stand here till you take root?"
Ringo looked at his feet. "I can't deal with this. I don't want to be here." Paul nearly threw up his hands in exasperation, but then he got an idea and said loudly, "Right, I'm not your mom. You're adults. Do as you please. I hope you find something to eat." He kicked off his shoes, scooped them up in his guitar, and trotted after George. Almost as an afterthought, he threw over his shoulder, "If you don't get eaten first!"
"Bugger off!" John screamed back, but Ringo gulped and hurried to catch up with Paul.
John watched the others dwindle with an attitude of melancholy satisfaction.
"They're all cracked," he said to the air. "Never see them again. Fuck knows what'll happen over there."
The three little white dots shrank further, now merely snowflakes against the grass.
"You wouldn't get me over there in a million years."
The air didn't reply. The water lapped at the shore. The sun shone down bright and hot. The leaves of the giant lettuce twitched in the breeze. And suddenly John was overwhelmed by the image of himself as a solitary white bean in the center of a plate that was getting larger and larger and larger. He tore off across the sand, hardly noticing the shoelace strap as it dug into his neck, the guitar as it bumped his stomach.
"Wait for me! Wait for me!"
"How long do you think his shoes will stay on? Whoops, there they go!" Gods, can't he think of any other way to curse than to say fuck? I thought he was supposed to be creative. If you'd included some sort of carrying implement for those instruments, he'd never have had to bore you thus. "Oral, why don't you just make a sign that says, 'You screwed up,' and flash it whenever you get the urge to point something out? I was under the impression, Varks, that you needed to see the screen occasionally." "Hush, you two. I want to hear those lovely Liverpudlian accents." Although the four were on the lookout for a dwelling in the ground, hobbit hole or something, the beachside farm that soon became visible in the distance filled the bill nicely. It boasted a long, low house, a smaller dwelling, a barn, animal pens, currently empty, several sheds, and a tiny dock with another shed on it and a rowboat tied up and bobbing in the water. All the buildings were made of wood and painted olive green. However, the houses and barns sported red, blue, and yellow designs within circles, like Pennsylvania Dutch hex signs.
There were other interesting details, but the four focused on only one. The bald man coming out of the house, dragging the barefoot gray person, a child they saw now, by the arm. The moment the man saw the four in the distance, he stopped short. The child slipped out of the man's grasp and darted behind him, clinging to his waist. The man glanced at the barn and whistled, two quick, piercing notes that drew two other men hurrying over, one carrying a pitchfork, the other a shovel. Then the bald man cupped his hand round his mouth and shouted to the four, "I be but a poor shirter wi' child and wife. English, thank God. Be you robbers, we fight you till we die, and dat be 10,000 evil ans for each of you. Be you honest men, only Dolans could welcome you more heartily." The words came slow and clear. The accent sounded vaguely Jamaican, vaguely Scandinavian. George started toward him right away, and what could the others do but follow? John and Paul padding along in their socks, shoes dangling from their hands. By the time they reached the spot where the man and child waited, the farmhands had also arrived, and the two sides eyed each other nervously. The four, even Ringo, towered over the adults. The tallest farmhand was perhaps 5'6", while the bald man was a few inches shorter than that. On the other hand, years of physical labor had given the men broad chests and thick, muscular arms, and the pitchfork had wicked points. They were all of the same genotype, ruddy Caucasian-colored, thick-boned and pudgy-faced, with small blobby noses and brown eyes, and they reeked of sweat and manure. The men wore leather boots that had seen much hard use, and their gray-brown woolen pants and shirts were rough and faded and well-patched. The child wore a shapeless long smock. The farmhands, young men in their early 20s, had long dark brown ponytails tied with faded red twine. Their eyebrows were either naturally thin or had been plucked in some fashion statement, and their faces were pocked with acne or smallpox scars. The bald man, 50-ish, had a bushy gray-brown walrus mustache and eyebrows to match. While his face was round and innocent, his gaze was sharp and appraising. "Aye," the bald man said with a nervous chuckle, looking up and up at the four. "When said Pelle dare be moon giants on de beach, I didn't believe him." He reached back and rumpled the hidden child's hair. "Be you just travelers, not robbers?" Paul stepped forward and opened his mouth to answer, and he was speaking to aliens. His little prepared speech flew right out of his head. "Ah," he stammered. George stepped forward, holding the seaweed sack out. We're not robbers." He swallowed to steady his voice. "Here, Pelle dropped this." A grateful, rather surprised smile lit up the bald man's face. Clearly he'd expected George to have claimed the bag for his own. "Good jan to you, stranger," he said, taking the bag and handing it down to Pelle, telling him, "Take it to Amma." The boy darted one more look at the giants before racing back to the house as fast as hauling the long sack would let him. The man opened his mouth as if to say something, looked at the farmhands, snapped his mouth shut, and scratched under his mustache instead. Then he pointed at George's guitar. "Be dat a musical instrument? Be you bards?" Solemnly, George played a few chords, the opening of My Sweet Lord. The farmhands' faces went from sullen to rapturous. "By passing! Han't heard music since never," one whispered. "Play it for us," the other asked shyly. "I gie my silver gry I got for digging wells at the castle." He dug in his pocket and offered a very grimy nickel-sized coin. "Oh, no, that's very kind of you, but you don't have to," George said. He hadn't understood most of what the farmhand had said, but he got the gist well enough. "I mean, we'd be happy to play for nothing." The bald man grinned, then quelled the farmhand's excitement with a quick whistle and a jabbed finger at the barn. "When Siopia sleeps," he told the men, who disappointedly drifted away, with many over-the-shoulder glances and whispered comments. When they were well away, the bald man's grin faded into a thoughtful, wary, serious look. He drew himself up and crossed his arms over his chest. "I be Stal Bess Fardodnamar, called Stal Last Man, as my farm be the last before de empty road to Jaran. Swear I by Dolans and Devassin dat my hands will cause you no harm. Be welcome, travelers." Stal moved his hands away from his body until his arms were spread wide, welcoming, trusting. "Thank you," George said gravely. "I'm George Harrison." The others also introduced themselves. Stal stared blankly at their response. No doubt he'd expected them to complete the welcoming ritual. However, before any of the four could worry, his grin returned. tempered with a bit of incredulous delight. And he lowered his arms and said to George, "Your names and speech be much different, and you be not like any of de peoples. Blow your shirts like de moons." "I could touch one?" George nodded, so the man reached out and rubbed a corner of T-shirt between his fingers. When he released the shirt, he left a smudge. "Soft," he said in wonderment and satisfaction. He bent forward and sniffed George around the chest. Despite himself, George leaned back, grimacing from the man's goat-like odor. "You even smell different." Then Stal straightened up, glanced around to make sure the farmhands hadn't come back, and said in a low, conspiratorial voice, "Came you cross chasm?" From his wide eyes to the quiver in his cheek, every bit of his manner begged, "Please say yes." Trusting that God wouldn't let him do anything suicidal this early in the adventure, George murmured, "Yes." For it was true, in a way. Stal breathed in sharply. "Came you not through Traitor Town and Focan?" "No," said Paul, finally finding his voice. "I mean, I don't think so. We don't know the name of things around here." He gave George a glance of disapproval for committing them to a role they knew nothing about, then beamed at the bald man. "We've only just arrived. It's quite lovely here. Very peaceful." "Focan be de city pull of here," said the man impatiently. "You did not dock dere?" "Remember, people from Cross Chasm use boats." "Though what was pull of here?" "Oh, no, we came from back that way," Paul pointed. "We landed in the on the beach." "Met you anyone else? Another traveler? An Idri?" "No, you're the first person we've met, unless an Idri is one of those big plants on the beach. Oh, and Pelly, of course." Stal began to tremble. Tears glimmered in his eyes. Although Paul was used to every kind of reaction when people met him, this man's distress disturbed him more than usual. Hastily he said, "Please don't be scared of us. We wouldn't even think of hurting you." "Nah, nah!" The man dashed the back of his hairy, stubby-fingered hand across his eyes, wiping the tears away, and when his arm lowered, he was smiling shyly. "I be not afraid. I be joyous. Never did I dream to speak with anyone from Cross Chasm. De Idris forbid it." "Why?" John said sharply. "And what's an Idri?" Stal scowled. "De Idri and Tagen. It be an old language name. It means de hands of de gods. Conquered de Katafa 40 years ago and brought back de gods." On that last word, George rounded on the bald man. "Where were the gods before that?" "Cross Chasm." Stal's tone of voice and puzzled expression clearly added, "What? You didn't know?" Not caring that he had started to tread on shaky ground, George persisted. "Which gods did they bring back?" "All 70 of them. Dalns, Pasik, Siopia, Parlani. Every one of de gods and goddesses dat came my ancestors to Katafa dat had not been in Katafa for 500 years. How about Lord Krishna? Lord Shiva? Ganesha?" Stal gave George a strange, oddly pleased look. "These be not names I know. Dere be Kazra, goddess of fishers." "Stal!" The thin nasal cry came from the barn, from which a one-horse cart had emerged. Everyone looked over. The driver waved. When he saw he had caught Stal's attention, he snapped the reins, urging the horse toward the little group. Stal hissed in exasperation, blowing out the ends of his mustache. "My candle flickers, honored guests. Please don't leave. I be back swiftly." Muttering under his breath, he trotted to meet the cart.